Welcome to the Rise and Scribe podcast. I'm Jordan Wyatt, and with me today is Steve McPherson. Steve, how you doing?
Hey, I'm pretty good. It's really, really, really cold in Minnesota.
Our cold front ended for a little bit. It's supposed to be like 52 today.
Uh-huh.
If that makes you jealous.
Yeah, wait, I 52, I don't know that number. That's not negative 52. It was negative 9.8 when I woke up this morning. So I slept in a tauntaun, so it was terrible.
All right, so we're going to do things a little bit differently today. This is for, I guess, lack of a better term, a literary X's and O's version of Rise and Scribe. I think that's fitting.
I like that term.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Sounds good.
So what Steve and I are going to do is we pick two stories, one apiece. We're going to break down one sports story and one non-sports story. We're just going to kind of go through them and what we liked, what we didn't like, why we liked them, you know, just kind of going through the style of it and, you know, hopefully give you guys some insight. So the first story is from October 2011. It's from GQ and a writer named Michael Paterniti. I read this story maybe once a month, maybe probably more than that, because it's my favorite story, favorite long form, I think, of all time, which is saying something. But it's called The Man Who Sailed His House. It's a fascinating read. It's about a guy named Hiramitsu who, it's like the article says, he literally sailed his house. He was on the roof of his house during this immense flood that washed everything away. So, Steve, what did you think of the story?
you gave this preamble of like it's the best thing ever, and now I have to.
For me, it is. For you, it's probably not.
I think that the thing that's going to strike anybody immediately on reading this story is the second person, you know, the choice of the second person. And POV is something that, which stands for point of view, if you're not familiar with advanced analytics. point of view is something that I took an entire class on, so you can ask me anything. I took an entire class on it in grad school when I was doing my MFA in creative writing, and mostly from the perspective of fiction writing. But the thing about POV is that it's one of these things that everybody kind of knows happens, and you can identify this is a first person story, this is a second person story, this is a third person story. But there's a lot more going on when you're choosing what your point of view is going to be. And so to pick a nonfiction, I would sort of lump this into creative nonfiction. A nonfiction story and tell it from a second person point of view is, it's a gambit. It's like it's throwing some chips on the table and being like, you're along for this ride. And it's really long. It's a really long story for a second person.
Mm-hmm.
There's only a couple novels that are really successful in the second person. I believe Bright Lights, Big City is in the second person. And it was notable for being in the second person. There's some short stories that are really successful in the second person. This one to me, it was sort of a mix of successful and difficult, sort of challenging in some ways for me because of that second person perspective. I think the writing was very strong. The writing is very good. It's evocative. It's really solidly written. So from a writing perspective, there's not really any problem with it. The problem that I think that comes in with a second person viewpoint is that as a nonfiction thing, I just kept thinking, you know, how much of this is his experience and how much of it is this writer imagining his experience, mm-hmm. and where are those lines? And it kept kind of pulling me out of the story because I couldn't tell if, you know, there wasn't any context given for me about, you know, did this writer interview Hiramitsu? Is it just pulled from accounts, other interviews that Hiramitsu gave to other people? Were those accounts translated from Japanese into English and then read by this writer and then reinterpreted into this story? So I think that, I mean, not to start too critically because it is really well written and it's a really enjoyable read. That was just the thing that kept pulling me out of it. I thought it was an interesting decision, but I was like, what am I missing out on? What is the gap between Hiramitsu, this actual person, and then this writer who is interpreting his story?
Yeah, the second person for me was really striking. It's what pulled me into the story for the entire time, because most features, most profiles, or you know, whatever you want to call them, it's they're usually third person. There's some first person, like, you know, first person, I guess, like interwoven with third person, whatever you want to call it. I'd never read one that was, for the most part, purely second person. But when you said it's a gamble, that was my thought as well. I thought it was also a little bit audacious, almost, to write this guy's entire experience. And essentially what he's doing is he's telling it back to him. So it's second person, but it's like it's second person aimed solely at one individual, which is Hiromitsu. And I thought that was a really interesting choice, and it was really intriguing to me. I do agree, though, that it's long for a second person, and it's you're not sure, like, did he sit by Hiromitsu's side while he was telling this entire story? That's why I'd always wanted to talk to Paternity about this piece, because I've always wanted to know, like, how much research how much personal interview went into this. Mm-hmm. I think the amount of research that had to go into a piece like that to feel comfortable and confident writing a second person narrative has to just be astounding, or you'd think it would be, at least you'd hope so, to write all of this from this guy's point of view and his perspective. You'd think and want to think that he did just immense amount of research, which was another piece that really struck me. But I guess at the time when I read it the first time, I didn't really think about, well, did he actually research it that much, or is this kind of his interpretation?
Yeah, it would be really interesting to be able to talk to him about the process for writing it. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty is that in the final product, there's really no evidence one way or the other that it was either well-researched or just completely made up.
Right.
You know, which is, you know, because you want to say, okay, GQ published this. They have standards, you know. But the other thing is that GQ also publishes straight fiction. So how much is this supposed to be, you know, an imaginative rendering of this, and how much of it is research? You know, there's these photos sort of sprinkled throughout, which are, you know, from things Hiromitsu had or things like that. But there's like these like quotes where he's like, this guy said this to Hiromitsu, and Hiromitsu says this, you know, it's all again in that second person, but I'm like, are those quotes, like, or is this paraphrase that's being used as quotes? And it's such a well-written piece that I want it to be true, but I'm somebody where I feel like my default setting is like, if it works in the end, I'm sort of an ends justifies the means kind of writer.
Sure.
And it's interesting because, like, my dad, for example, is the complete – not the complete opposite of this. But I distinctly remember going to see Memento, the movie, and thinking, this is a terrific movie. And then I recommended it to my dad, and he went and saw it. And he was like, I liked it, but I really need to go back and see if it all actually fits together. And then if it all fits together, then I'll like it. And I'm kind of like, what? Did you enjoy it or did you not enjoy it? You know? And so, but this is a situation where I find myself getting to the end of it and saying, I enjoyed that, but I can't tell if it's good unless I know whether, like, exactly what the distance was for this writer from the experience. You know, if Paternity interviewed Hiromitsu in person and in his native language, then that, to me, I'm like, slam dunk, you know, home run, basically. If it's cobbled together from accounts that are translated from Japanese into English, that it's a well-written piece of imaginative nonfiction. But I don't know, maybe it just sort of changes the stakes for me if it's not done, if it's being done in a not completely primary sourced kind of way.
Sure. And it's interesting that you mention, like, the details, because it's not as if this article lacks for details. Like, so even in the first paragraph, it talks about 5:30 a.m. in Frigid. The first priority is the pigeons in the barn. Fresh water with their corn, wheat, and barley mix bought from the shop. The wire cage holds all 30 iridescent heads bobbing as they hungrily peck. And there are lots of those details about where he lived or what his schedule was, sprinkled throughout the piece. So again, that kind of like pulls me more towards he talked to him or talked to his family or something like that. I mean, he even goes, you pull on your sneakers, slip into a purple fleece worn over your red and gray wool flannel, then the heavy green jacket. Like, you would think he wouldn't like imagine that. It's like, what was he wearing that day? All right, I'm going to give him a green jacket and underneath that. Like, so, but it is interesting. And so that's what makes me think that there's just a wealth of research that goes into the piece.
Yeah. Clearly we need to get in touch with Michael Paterniti.
I've been trying and my attempts have just been incredibly unfruitful.
Yeah.
But to me, what I really love about this piece is, again, it's the second person, but the rhythm of the piece. It always – there's just such a nice flow to it. There's rarely ever like an odd break in the action or in the flow. And so you just kind of follow along with it really easily. And it's just beautiful. Like it's a sad story, obviously, one that ends up kind of okay. But it's just beautiful, and he really gets into, and again, like we're hoping that this is coming from a primary thing, but he really gets into the mindset of what it felt like to be stranded out there. But you know, both from like an emotional and a physical standpoint. The story just always resonated with me, and second person always for some reason really sticks with me. I really enjoy well-written second person narratives. Because it's doing its purpose. It is literally speaking to you, putting you as the character.
Yeah, and again, the writing is the voice is so consistent. You know, I think it's he does a great job of having he keeps the sentences fairly short, and kind of austere, but kind of spiked with great little details and everything.
Right.
And this, again, speaks to the same stuff that we already talked about. I sort of have this concern of, like, to what extent is – I'm assuming that Michael Paterniti is not Japanese.
He is not.
Based on that name. and that is problematic in some ways as well, because I feel like he's sort of adopting a kind of Japanese-style voice.
That's interesting.
Is – entirely appropriate if your subject is Japanese in some ways, but again, if this does not involve primary sourced material, then there begins to be a kind of weird Orientalism going on here, where you're sort of imbuing this situation with all kinds of ideas about Japanese austerity and meditative natural, like, sort of, there's so many stereotypically Japanese things about the way stuff is described in this. There is also Japanese culture, which is grounded in some of these ways of describing things. So, it's really on this edge. And maybe that's it's part of what makes it interesting to read also. But it's difficult. I think you can run across this, even in terms of thinking about, basketball, and trying to think about how, athletes. I'm not a professional athlete. I had never played organized basketball at all, and yet a lot of my time is spent trying to get into the mindset of people who grew up playing basketball all the time, many of whom are from disadvantaged economic circumstances, which I am not from either. So I think in any writers generally are trying to inhabit foreign consciousnesses, and to what extent is that part of the job, and to what extent do you need to be respectful of those other consciousnesses, and to what extent do you have, the right to inhabit those consciousnesses it's a really tough question, right? So, I sort of feel on the fence about it.
Was it tough for you to read this just from a perspective of enjoying a piece and then reading it, for lack of a better term, analytically? Do you find yourself doing that? Like having that struggle, not just with this piece, but I guess like any piece, really.
I will say that I think that my tendency to read things analytically, if I begin to have troubles analytically with it, will get in the way of my pure enjoyment. If I'm enjoying something and I'm finding that analytically I'm also enjoying it, then there doesn't tend to be a problem. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. you know, so, you know, for example, the Wire, which is, I'm rewatching The Wire like everybody is. And one of the things, and that's a show where there's so many things you miss the first time through, but I sort of enjoyed it just in terms of the overall effect that it was having. And then now that I'm watching it for, you know, the fourth, maybe fifth time or something like that, you begin to pick up these little details of the relationship between the characters in a way that's just, it's so lovely the way that they, that the characters are rendered on that show. And so consistent, and there's so few shows that do that well. That now when I'm watching it, I am picking it apart analytically, but I'm getting joy out of that, out of taking it apart at mm-hmm. this point. Which, you know, I guess the thing is that when the taking it apart gets in the way, because I feel like it's not, there's that I have issues with it, then it can sort of, it takes away from just the pure line by line enjoyment of reading the piece. That definitely happens.
Sure. Before we move on to your piece, I was reading through this and there are a lot of paragraphs like this, but I think one paragraph that kind of encapsulates a lot of what we talked about, both from the writing style, like where you said, there's, it's kind of written in a Japanese style. The fact that you hope there's a lot of research that went into this, and just the fact that it's a really well written piece. It's on the second page. It starts, it's the last paragraph. It goes, "Let it go, Hiromitsu, man of men. You had your reasons for staying, and you stayed." So right there, it kind of goes into writing in second person, but not quite putting the reader as the central character. It's, again, it's more, I think, if anything, a letter back to Hiromitsu. Then it continues, "2 days before, there'd been another tsunami warning that came to naught. Some had rushed to high ground, and then nothing. In a land of tremors and quakes, of errant waves, and a history of coastal destruction, the people had grumbled a little. Too many false warnings, and with so much to get done." And that right there is again, kind of like a Japanese style, as what you were talking about.
Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, it's so tough as a writer, because there's some things that you write that, I mean, I think you sometimes you'll just go for something and you don't know. I mean, like the man of men kind of sticks out to me. It's like, I'm like, I don't even know what you mean. it has this poetic, I mean, there's sort of this poetic license thing there, right? That it's right. Like, you know, if the reader is with you by this point, they're going to stick with you through this. But if they're kind of not with you, I'm kind of like, man of men, like let it go, Hiromitsu, dude. Like you're a guy. Like, you know what I'm saying? This is the thing with each. I mean, I think that any writer has to think about this. I talk about this a lot. I teach writing as well, and you know, you got to think about your audience, right? And audience doesn't mean you're trying to get everybody to pay attention to what you're doing. It's mm-hmm. it's not even that necessarily you want your audience to be your readers. Like your actual readers are going to be, some are going to be into it, some aren't going to be into it, some are going to be perfect for it. But your audience is like who you're angling it toward. And even though, I mean, I know the second person thing is, I mean, I don't want to get into a whole thing about what second person does or what it means or things like that. Like it's not as simple as you're trying to make the reader be the hero. It's not like a choose your own adventure. That's a different kind of second person, you know. It's different than that. It's like it does something to the point of view. In some ways it can be a letter, like you're saying. It sort of vibrates between different meanings a lot of times, you know. So I don't want to get into a whole thing about second person, but it's just that you aim for this audience and then you just accept that you're going to lose some people. And even as I'm reading this and knowing you, I'm like, this is right. You are the audience for this piece. Like yes. You are perfect for this. I think I am less perfect for this particular piece. But I can appreciate, you know, how well the writing itself is done.
Right. And we talked about this, a few months ago where we kind of talked about how you go about writing a piece like that and if you feel like you're ready. And I think this kind of goes back to the whole audacity of the thing. Is it a question of, do you have to have some sort of experience or some sort of, for lack of a better term, like resume in order to be able to write a story like this? Or is it just kind of one of those things where when you have the story and you think you can write it like this, just why not give it a shot?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. You know, and I think that the professional – I think a lot of times when you see people come out of nowhere with something like as well-formed as this or something, it's because they just shot for the moon. And
right.
It was a compelling enough story that it just had to happen and it just had to be written. I think the more you write on the regular, in some ways the harder it is to just pull off stuff like this. You know what I mean? Like – you begin to just do more stuff that's like the job you have to do, you know? I mean, it's kind of why the dream, like when I was doing my MFA and I was studying fiction mostly, I've written some fiction. I've had some of it, some people have published it in places, but, not a ton. I have a hard time really diving into fiction. I really like nonfiction though. But it always seemed to me like the dream would be to get the gigs that guys like Ben Percy, who I did a writing workshop with. He's a great writer. Or like Wells Tower, who's another guy that I did a workshop with. Like they write fiction, but then they write these things for GQ and Esquire and, you know, these sort of nonfiction where there's like, I'm going to go to Amsterdam and smoke a lot of weed. Tell you about that. I mean, not that I want to go to Amsterdam and smoke a lot of weed. I don't actually, but you know, things like that. Like I just want that part of the gig.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Like where you don't have to do the hard work of actually writing books, which is what I'm trying to get back into now. So, I just want the part where you get to write, 3,000 to 5,000 word, things about nonfiction stuff. But I don't want to have to do the write those things about the boring stuff as well. I don't know. I guess I just want the cherry. I don't want to have to do all the work to get there. I'm so lazy.
I think that's basically like the dream gig for any writer.
Basically.
Like, let me do the cool stories and
GQ just call you and be like, hey, listen, can you go to South America and oh, sure, totally.
It's like, well,
study butterflies. Yeah.
All right, so that takes care of the paternity piece. Now we're going to move on to your piece. So do you want to go ahead and give a little spiel about what you chose?
Well, I chose the piece is called Everybody Loves Mike. It's about Mike Miller, and it's by Jonathan Abrams, who friend of the show. Can I say that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hero of the show. Abrams, I got to meet him once. I chatted with him for a while at NBA Summer League. And there's guys who are – like born writers. I mean, there's guys who cover basketball really well, who have incredibly comprehensive knowledge of the game itself. Then there are guys and women. When I say guys, I mean, sorry, I'm using I'm going to call that gender neutral. There are writers who are amazing writers and who happen to write about basketball in great ways. Somebody like Zach Lowe, to me, it has both of those things in a lot of ways. Abrams is like a human storyteller, though, and that's mm-hmm. what's so great about him. I mean, he just every time anybody who is on basketball Twitter and following it knows as soon as the Abrams piece drops, it's like you gotta go read the Abrams piece.
Yep,
because he just and talk about research. I mean, it's just clear that he spends a lot of time talking to a lot of people. You know, he sort of has this. He's done oral histories and he's done things like this, but this kind of piece is my favorite kind of thing where he focuses on a player and doesn't even necessarily talk about their stats, doesn't really talk about, how good they are from three-point range or what their true shooting percentage is or what kind of plays are used to get them open or anything else like that. It's just about the journey of a player to where they are. And Miller is an interesting subject for me because I hate him. I don't hate him personally. But as a basketball player, first of all, he was Rookie of the Year, right?
Like one of the worst draft classes,
right? Exactly, and that was one of those things. It was at a point when I was just starting to get into basketball, and I was like, really, this doughy, crew cut, like Midwestern, like corn fed white dude is the Rookie of the Year. I just laid bare like every prejudice I have against corn fed college ball players. So I was just like, I was not interested in him whatsoever. Then he came to the Timberwolves at a time when the Timberwolves were awful, and he was awful. I mean, it was like the Wolves didn't have any shooters, and you're like, let's bring in this guy who's a 3-point specialist, and then he never shot the ball. Like, he was like, I'm gonna have a lot of assists. You're like, what are you doing? Like, and you know, he had long hair, and he had like every accessory on every piece of his body. He had like a hairband and like elbow pads and knee pads and long johns and like gloves. Like, it was just ridiculous. I just hated him. I just hated everything about his style of playing. And then I read this piece, and it's just like, everybody likes this guy. And you know, I don't know that the piece itself changed my mind about my feelings about Mike Miller just as a sort of basketball player, but as a human being, I really came to appreciate, you know, Abrams really laid bare the way that, you know, in talking to a lot of different people, he's just a player who's been in every kind of different circumstance, you know, like starting from the beginning, and his recruitment and his journey through college and then into the pros, where he's been on rebuilding teams, he's been on contenders, he's been on championship teams, he's been on cellar dwellers, he's just sort of done everything, and he's always managed to maintain like good relationships with everybody he plays with, and everybody just says fantastic things about him, and he's like a real people person, and it's the kind of profile that Abrams is so well suited to do, because it's a way to measure kind of that veteran leadership thing that's just not going to come across in like looking at, you know, box scores and stuff like that. And I think that, you know, sometimes it's the kind of thing that it's hard to measure, and so people don't know what to do with it. But I think reading Abrams on some of these guys who are these sixth men, these bench guys, that's really where you find out about this stuff. And it doesn't have to mean that they're great on the court, or that they make a difference in a championship run, or that they make a clutch 3-pointer. But it's just reading about the human part of the game, and that's what I really like about it. And I think Abrams is great for that.
I have a few thoughts on this, and my first one is that a lot of profiles of players are pretty formulaic. And I don't mean to diss anybody, but like, because, you know, they're good pieces, but a lot of them kind of follow that same formula of player X started from the bottom, now they're here. Mm-hmm. What Abrams does here is that's not that at all. It does what the best profiles do. It gives you a look into a certain aspect of a player, and from that kind of extrapolates something that has meaning to basketball as a whole. And so it's not just this player, even though a lot of this is biographical in that it's, you know, where he started from, how he was recruited, and then, you know, how he ended up in the NBA. It's not just about that. That's not the purpose of the story. And then the chronological approach was interesting to me. One of the first things I really struggled with as a writer when it came to writing profiles or features was I got way too chronological. Mm-hmm. And this is something James Herbert talked to me about, is that you don't always have to start from the beginning. You can start from the middle. You can start at the end. You can start not even talking about the subject. You know, it's because the beginning isn't always the beginning, if that makes sense. You know, right. It's not always your start. And what Abrams did here, he starts right in with the trade, when he traded Mike Miller. And it's a great lead because not only does it give you right in the middle of the action, it also right away shows you how important Miller was to a certain teammate, and it sets the tone for the rest of the piece. Mm-hmm. There is one thing that, if I have a qualm with this piece, I almost felt like I didn't get enough quotes as to how much people loved Mike Miller. it's weird. Like, everybody says how much, you know, why they enjoy him and how he's helped them out. But I guess I was just missing like that one, like, let me tell you how great Mike Miller is. He, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There were things that approached that, but it almost felt like it didn't quite get there, at least for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can see that. I mean, I guess I think that maybe there was so much of, you know, wanting to also do his history that you couldn't – it didn't just want to be like – you didn't just want to talk to people now about how Mike Miller is now. You wanted to make sure you're getting a full picture of him. And so to that extent, I mean, but I see what you're saying. I can see what you're saying. I think the structural thing is really interesting, and I think that's another thing that I don't know if you can plan that. My sense is probably that Abrams has just learned it from years of doing this, like to learn the feel of where to start something. And, you know, I struggle with it. Okay, here's the thing. I don't struggle with it, but I'm not always good at it. Like, I'm completely confident starting in the left field, and I'm like, yes. And then it goes to an editor, and they're like, no. Like, let's not start there. But, you know, Abrams has earned that. You know, like, it's interesting if you go down, like, it's the third big chunk where it starts at the beginning, right? Boy or girl, you really didn't have a choice of whether you played basketball in the Miller family. Basically, in our family, they put a ball in your hands the day you were born, said Ryan Miller, one of Mike's two older brothers. The Millers are a South Dakota basketball dynasty. Mike's father, Tom, and his two younger brothers all started at Dakota Wesleyan University, where Mike's uncle, Alan, ended his career as the state's all-time leading scorer. Now, that's the beginning, right?
Yeah.
That would be a terrible lead. You know, like, I mean, the first sentence is fine. Boy or girl, you really didn't have a choice of whether you played basketball in the Miller family. But it's one of those things where, because it's foregrounded, like it's set up with so much stuff before that, you've earned the capital to then go into this backstory, right? Like, nobody actually cares what Mike Miller's father's name is. Nobody actually cares. I mean, Mike Miller cares. Nobody actually cares that his two younger brothers, like, that stuff, like, that's not important. Really, but it needs to get in there as a kind of – it's material, right? You know, it's like it's history. It's background. But it's really – you don't want to start with background. Like, you want to start with action. And so that's why it's good that, like, it starts with an – you know, action. It's not like it starts with a car chase. But, you know, it starts with emotions, right? Like,
yes.
Magic traded Mike Miller. Tracy McGrady is constantly complaining about the deal, irritated Doc Rivers. So you've got characters, you've got McGrady, you've got Rivers, you've got Miller, and you've got irritation. So you've got, like, emotion there, which is what you don't really get out of the beginning of things a lot of time. So that sort of in media res thing is great for that. And I think that Abrams is really smart with this, you know, sort of the way he jumps around from time to time to time. Now, when I started first writing fiction, I started jumping around from time to time to time to time. And then I got my hands slapped. I got the ruler across the back of my knuckles. Because the flip side to it is that if there's not a reason to take it out of chronological order, don't take it out of chronological order. You know what I mean? Like, there's – it sort of goes back to the Hiramitsu thing, right? Which is basically told start to finish. Right?
Yeah.
And that's the thing is that in that situation, it's perfect for that because, you know, there's almost no other. If you started breaking up the chunks of, like, if you started with him being rescued and then you went back to him on the raft and then you went back to hit the tsunami happening, I mean, maybe you could make it work, but there's just not a reason to do that. Whereas with Mike Miller's career, like, to jump from the beginning to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing, there'd be these gaps, whereas you can just go backwards and then the picking and choosing. You know, Abrams makes it make sense because of the sort of emotional weight that each chunk carries. And I think that's the kind of thing that you only really learn by doing it and through experience.
Yeah. And yeah, I agree with everything you just said.
Good. Then we're done here. No, I'm sorry.
And, you know, obviously, you know, Abrams is a great writer, but so much of his stuff is just further bolstered by the quotes he's able to get and by what he's able to get players to say. And it's such an underrated ability to just be so good, not even at – it may not even be a question of asking the right questions or asking the perfect question. It could just be the fact that people are comfortable talking around you, or you know how to approach players. You know what to ask them. You know how to ask them. You know how to converse with them, which is also a very underrated skill. Like, it can't just be question and answer. Sometimes it has to be a conversation in order to get that quote that you want.
Yeah.
And Abrams is just so good at it. And, you know, you really get a lot of those here.
Yeah. I wonder with Abrams, it's something I would like to ask him now, is, you know, how much of the iceberg are we seeing here with the quotes? Because I think a lot of writers I mean, different places approach this. Different publications approach this in a different way. You know, if you're writing like a gamer, like a recap, right, for like a straight up mainstream publication, you know, I've seen this happen. It's like you get in there, you ask your question or your two questions, you get your quotes, and then you go write them. You know, if I'm writing stuff, I often like to include a lot of stuff that might not go directly toward what happened in a game, but sort of gets the flavor of the way the person talks or thinks, right? Mm-hmm. But then some places don't want that much of that. Drew Hoop is an example of an outlet where I've written stuff for them, and they often come back and say, this is too quote heavy. And then I need to carve away some of the quote stuff to make it, to put more of my perspective into it, which is fine as well. But I'm kind of like, I like the subject to speak. So I always wonder with Abrams if it's like, you know, if the quotes he's getting, how much of that is he using? And how long did it take him to get to that point? Because I think it's definitely true when you, if you begin to form a relationship with players and you begin to have a reputation around, you know, the league as like, you're a guy who does this kind of stuff, then people are just going to be more comfortable talking to you, you know? But I think you're right that I think it has to build out from not just every time you're in the locker room, like recorder out, like, here's my two awesome questions that I really thought of.
Right.
I think to a certain extent, it's good to just, you know, chit chat, you know, like, and I think that sometimes those relationships build up over a long time, and you have to be patient with that as a writer and know that you're laying in that groundwork, which can be difficult, but I think it's how you eventually end up getting really good stuff.
One paragraph, or I guess two paragraphs that I want to go through, which are just a really perfect blend of storytelling, integrating quotes, and letting yourself tell the action and also letting the player tell the action. So it's a ways down. It's when he's talking about Miami's comeback. And so it starts, "So began Miami's comeback. Chalmers started the quarter with a three-pointer. James followed with a layup. Soon after, Miller lost his left shoe while defending a Tiago splitter post-up. I couldn't get it on, so just threw it to the sideline and tried to space the floor for LeBron," Miller said. "That's all I was thinking. Stay on space, let him go to work, and I'll foul someone next time down." So that sets the stage really well, even though it's kind of mundane up to that point in a good way. Then it continues, "Gary Neal made the mistake of assuming that Miller, playing in one sock and one sneaker, was now neutralized. So Neal ran off to double-team James. He left me, and there was nothing else I could do," Miller said. If I had tried to dribble, I had sweaty socks on. I was going to slide all over the place. So I do what I do best. Let it fly, brother." it's just a great end to that action. And then he has a quote from Haslam just after that. "The shot didn't even draw iron as it passed through the net. Shoes on, shoes off, high heels, boots, whatever. He's one of the best shooters I've ever seen," Haslam said. "Once he let it go, I knew it was going down." And it's just like that perfect little cherry on top of what was already a really good job of telling the action and letting a player say, not just like a typical, "Oh yeah, I had an open look, so I shot it." There's, you know, adding some kind of fun narrative into that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, and that's, you know, it's interesting because Abrams is almost the exact opposite of sort of what we were praising in Paternity, which is that, you know, he's translucent as a writer. Like you don't really get, you know, as writers, you can appreciate the craft that's going into it, but he's not going to use the $50 word. You know, he's not going to, he's not going to show off. He's not going to draw literary parallels. You know, he's not going to do crazy stuff like that. I mean, which is all stuff that I like to do. You know, he's not, you know, I think it's important. I mean, I feel like I'm trying to cultivate like some more of just the straight writing as well for myself, like to not be so like, here's how, you know, I remember one of the first things that I wrote for Grantland was how Tim Duncan's post-up game is like Bushido Blade. This,
I remember that.
And it was like, I think one of the first comments was like, is this a parody of a Grantland article? Cause it was the kind of thing where it's like, once I started getting into writing about basketball, I was like, I would really like to write for Grantland because I think in this weirdo way, you know, which is, I think it takes all kinds, you know, like everybody doing different kinds of stuff. But I just have such an appreciation for, it's not like Abrams is Hemingway. He's not out here with like this granite carved language that's like so straightforward. But it's just, it's lovely writing that doesn't, it just recedes into the story itself. And that's, I think that's a lot harder to achieve than people realize.
Yeah. I think it's another skill that's undervalued, a way to progress a story while not getting in the way of the quotes, but at the same time, like, not just doing paragraph quote, paragraph quote, paragraph quote, which is what a trap a lot of people fall into, because it's almost the easiest thing to do.
It's not I think that a lot of people tend to think that either that's the way they have to write, because that's the way that, you know, beat writers write, mm-hmm. or they have to make themselves stand out because, you know, Hunter S. Thompson did gonzo journalism and I'm going to do that in basketball. I think the skill is really valued by people, but I just think there's not that many people who are really good at it.
Yeah, that's right.
James Herbert is an example of somebody who I think is also good at that. He's so good at that. Like, just
yes.
the profiles that are so clean and so well written and so enjoyable to read and don't call attention to the writing itself at all. It's awesome. And it's terrific writing. So it is underappreciated in the sense that I think we don't necessarily hold those ones up as the profiles that we're all, you know, tweeting out or sharing or talking about or things like that. But I think they're doing really important work. Those are some of the most fun to read pieces.
And I think it's also a tough thing to fight too. Like, as a writer, you want to impress people. You want to say, look, I can use this word. Look how well I can craft a sentence. And you have to fight that when it comes to these sorts of pieces, because you're not the story here.
Yeah. 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 It's absolutely. Yeah. I think that that's absolutely true. Some people are naturally more self-effacing. It's easier for them to get out of the way of the piece itself. But yeah, it's like, you know, you sort of think, hey, this is my chance to shine doing this thing. And so you sort of place yourself in front of the subject, which is generally not good. I don't know. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, you always, I think you just need to know going into it what you're writing. Because sometimes it's fine to write things that are kind of in first person or about, you know, that have I in them, that have a perspective that is your own perspective on something. But it's also good to be able to not do that, you know, I think flexibility is always, it's like basketball players themselves, right? It's like you have what you could be really good at, but what you're naturally good at, but you want to cultivate those talents outside of what your strength is.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, do you have anything else on this?
I don't think so. I'm good. More Jonathan Abrams pieces, please.
Okay. my ending tale about Abrams is when I introduced myself to him at Summer League, and I said, "Mr. Abrams, my name is Jordan White. I really admire your work." And he just goes, "Don't call me Mr. Abrams."
There you go. That's a secret. Just be cool with him. Yeah. So
yeah.
Yeah. I think that's. I mean, as stupid as it is, it's like in terms of that relationship with how you get along, talk to people, and just in doing this generally, like I still talk about weather with players all the time. Like,
yeah.
You know, I know it sounds so dumb, but like, you know, like Troy Daniels just got traded to the Timberwolves, and so the other night was the first time I was in the locker room after a game, and he was there, and you know, I was just wrapping up, and I was like, how are you adjusting to the climate? He's like, it is freezing. I was like, it's a little different than Houston, right? He's like, oh god. I was like, where'd you grow up? And he's like, Virginia. And he was like, yeah, it gets cold there, but not like this. I was like, yeah, you know, just get some long underwear and, you know, just put it on pretty much no matter what, and then you can get through it. And you know, it's like, it's just kind of a good conversation to have. Like,
and so you're more than just a face to a person,
right? Exactly. So you're not just like a recorder in front of them, you know.
Yeah.
I think because I, you know, I like to try to get to know people a little bit. I mean, I talked about when Corey Brewer was in Minnesota, like we talk about our kids and stuff like that. And, you know, I think that stuff, you can't force it. You just gotta, you know, just keep actually talking to these people like they're human beings and not just, you know, number generators.
All right. Well, I think that concludes the first Literary X's and O's podcast. We'll try and do this weekly, maybe a little bit less regularly, but there will be more. That's what I'm trying to say.
I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. Thanks, Steve.
All right. Thanks. Alrighty. I'm stopping my recording.